Paris, Radio Paris, Radio Paris est allemand, Radio Paris, Radio Paris, Radio Paris est allemand.
Aujourd'hui, 615e jour de la lutte du peuple français pour sa libération.
Ici Londres. Vous allez entendre les informations en français. Veuillez écouter tout d'abord quelques messages personnels. La villa est silencieuse. L'étoile filante repassera. Le chien du jardinier pleure. La belle aussitôt la suit. Nous disons la belle aussitôt la suit. La dernière heure a sonné. Gabriel garde l'anonyme. Le manchot la serre dans ses bras. Nous disons le manchot la serre dans ses bras deux fois. Le fantôme n'est pas bavard. Les bombardements sont massifs. L'abbé est nerveux. Nous disons l'abbé est nerveux. Le gigot est cuit. Il y aura quatre pains. La cruche n'ira plus à l'eau. Nous disons la cruche n'ira plus à l'eau. La bibliothèque est en feu. Nous disons la bibliothèque est en feu deux fois. Du ciel à la terre, un ami viendra vous voir ce soir. Il y a du mieux, camarade.
Sur mon lit à bouffer sa langue en buvant en mon whisky. Quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris, mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash. En quatre couleurs. Allez hop, un matin, une louloute est venue chez moi, poupée de cellophane, cheveux chinois, un sparadrap, une gueule de bois. A bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc.
And then now, let's hope that there's no commercial. Oh, there is a Wells Fargo commercial. All right, well, welcome to The Influence Show, episode 6, with my co-host, Kristen Gwynn.
What's up?
Our special guest for tonight, Miss Anna Day.
Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome.
We're really happy to have you.
Thanks, guys.
And on deck...
Walters! Nouveau phénoménal, freeze down du visage pâle. Le bateau est de retour à Arthur. C'est parti, ça vient de s'anner. Direct, issu de la génération fort qui t'a gêné. Pas de souci, mais pas de chip ici. Pas de chichi si tu diras pour te chier dessus. Trop de blabla, trop de plagiat. Trop de merde, son critique t'épera. Mais c'est comme ça. Connecto, le bénéf, le business. Et c'est pendant qu'on laisse couler que les pédales le sol reste. Et puis, ça bive de nous, rêve de voir le sous. Ne t'approche pas au long de bon te fout des coups de peu bon. Si tu respectes pas les règles, mec du béton, pour finir aux côtés des faibles, ceux qui ne voient le hip-hop qu'avec des samples de pop. Mec, tout cela je les stoppe à base de pop, pop, pop. Same, same, stand. Fous donc ton gilet pare-balles à base de pop, 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 pop. Mais pour le hip-hop je développe la scène sunny. C'est de la bombe bébé. Et si t'as le pédigré, ça s'en connaît au bébé. C'est de la bombe bébé. Same, same, bébé. C'est de la bombe bébé,
c'est de la bombe bébé. Oh, ça vient de Sunny, tu reconnais la race, alors fais-toi.
C'est ça tout.
Prends le double R des boules pour te mettre l'enfer. Tu crois que tu les agroses, mais qu'est-ce que pas double R le tonnerre.
L'expert de la maison mère, à qui tu la frappes à l'envers. Négro c'est clair, je suis slay, super bad.
Mais t'as pas
vache en mission. Ne cherche pas, de toute façon faut pas que ça traîne, parce qu'on a plus le temps pour ça. C'est pas demain je passerai la main ou j'arrêterai le combat. C'est clair que je vis que pour ça. Et puis je pense que comme ça je bouge pas. Plus le temps j'en vois, je balance des bons pour qu'à s'en vanter. Je peux chanter que je roule avec un trou, les gens te prennent. J'en bats ton cou, c'est le scène, nous flou.
Scène, scène, esther. Faut donc ton gilet pare-balles à base de pop, 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 pop. Mais pour le hip hop, je développe la scène, ça n'est. C'est de la bombe, bébé. Et si t'as le pédigré, ça s'en connaît au bébé. Faut donc ton gilet pare-balles à base de pop, 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 pop. Mais pour le hip-hop, je développe la scène, ça n'est. C'est de la bombe, bébé. Et si t'as le pédigré, ça se reconnaît au début.
Mais non, ici c'est oh.
Sandy, Sandy, fond, fond du flèche. Sandy, Sandy, fond, fond du flèche.
Dans l'arène, le suprême, la crème, la suite sur le plateau. Tu connais le deal, les gros, pas besoin de j'en passe trop. C'est moi la voix qui fait ta tessie dans tous ces états.
Tu
kiffes pas. Comment viendra à toi, voilà pourquoi j'ai pas le droit. J'lâche pas 9-3,
j'suis le droit
avec un fond bestial.
Ça c'est le sinistère.
C'est le sinistère.
C'est le sinistère.
C'est le sinistère.
Bébé, c'est le sinistère. Faut donc ton gilet pare-balles à base de pop, 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 pop. Mais pour le hip-hop, je développe la scène sanie. C'est de la bombe, bébé. Et si t'as le pédigré, ça se connaît au début. C'est le sinistère. Faut donc ton gilet pare-balles à base de pop, 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 pop. Mais pour le hip-hop, je développe la scène sanie. C'est de la bombe.
All right, guys, welcome back. That was, of course, the famous French rap group NTM, which stands for Nique ta mère, which literally means fuck your mother. And there's a reason that I chose to play that song tonight. It's because I feel that in the wake of the like truck attack that happened in Nice today that killed at least 77 people, it's important to remember that everything that rules about France is because of open and multicultural and sexually deviant France. So we can never forget that. And
everything that rules in a cool way.
Exactly. And before that, we had Plastique Bertrand with Sa Plane Pour Moi, which is a song that's been heard by every American person. And they don't know that that French people have no idea what he's talking about either. And before that, we had the BBC's Les Français Parlent Français, which was a 1 hour of French language programming during the Nazi occupation of France that the BBC would play for French people, and they would send secret messages to the resistance. So that was also a lot of nonsense, but it instructed somebody to blow up like a Nazi train or something, so it's good.
Woo!
Woo! So, anyway.
Good start.
Good start. Okay, well, Anna Day.
Hi, Matt.
How are you doing?
Well, how are you?
Somebody that I've never met before.
Yeah, strangers.
So we're meeting, meeting for the first time.
Love you, Matt.
Love you too, Anna. I miss you.
I miss you too.
And I was really bummed that you got arrested. But actually, you know, honestly, let's just get right into it. I have to say that the powwow around your arrest was more fun than your general powwow.
Wait, are you saying the Facebook threads were better than my parties?
They were fun. It was fine. Like, we were worried at the same time, but we were like,
she's got this.
She's got this. Like, we were like, buffering, like, come on. You know?
The mobilization helped.
It did?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm happy. Yeah. Yeah, we fucked them over in like 72 hours, you know? We're like, oh, you don't stand a chance. So, definitely. I prank called their embassy also.
Woo.
Yeah.
Pat is great at trolling embassies.
Yes, I'm blocked by several embassies. Actually, no, I'm sorry, that's inaccurate. I'm blocked by one embassy. I'm blocked by the Egyptian embassy. And I was just blocked today, actually, by a major neo-Nazi account on Twitter.
Congratulations.
So I humiliated Nazis on Twitter to the point where they had to block me.
What a troll. Life accomplishment.
Troll. I used to do a similar thing on the internet. What was it called? Now I can't think of it. Chat roulette.
Oh God.
I would wear this mask from this terrorist game actually that said evil on the forehead. Mm-hmm. So it was like a board game, and I would wear the mask that said evil and have a hammer and hammer at the camera, and then also put Cheez-Its up and spell die with them, and then put them in my mouth. And my goal was to get the dicks to pass me. And I got dozens.
But they probably
did
were into
any
it.
Did the dicks stay on?
Some did, but most of them left. And I had never seen a dick flee like that from an internet chat room. Anyway.
Dick flee. Guys, we are off to a great start. It usually doesn't deteriorate.
It's natural.
It usually doesn't deteriorate until about like 10 minutes in. So, oh, it is about 10 minutes in. There you go.
Hey.
Amazing. Into 10 minutes into the conversation, just so I can save myself. So anyways, Bahrain. Anna.
This is Anna Day. She's an awesome reporter.
Anna Day's an awesome reporter who was just arrested a couple months ago in Bahrain. Fucked over by monarchy. And, so tell us a little bit about, like, what Bahrain is. And
tell us about why you went there.
Why you went there.
Definitely. Bahrain is the home to America's Fifth Fleet, which is the base of operations for most of America's national security concerns, not only from Afghanistan, but all the way through Iraq, ISIS, but down to Somalia. So it's a huge command center. And little do most Americans know that this tiny little island that houses our Fifth Fleet is a kingdom that's been closed off to much of the world, where the monarchy is repressing the majority of the population. And that's what we were there to report on, the compromises that America makes in the name of national security.
Yeah. And in what's important to remember about this is that just like so many of the other Arab countries in 2011, there was sort of a political thawing in Bahrain of the Arab Spring, which is it's very important to remember that these happened in countries which are supposed to be sectarian enemies. So Yemen, which is majority Shia, had an uprising in 2011 inspired by Sunni Egypt. Bahrain in 2011 had an uprising inspired by countries that were not necessarily of the same sect. Same thing with Syria. So it's very important to remember that when this began,
it was just the youth rising up.
It was the youth rising up. And in Yemen and in Bahrain, we saw cross-sectarian opposition to authoritarianism. So what's interesting about the way that the United States reacted is that in 2011, when Mubarak was on the verge of being toppled, I think the Obama administration did something that's very courageous, is they basically said, fuck you, you're on your own, in terms of him. And they didn't give him backing, and they let him be toppled, which I think was actually very courageous.
In Egypt, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But in contrast, in Bahrain, the United States more or less green-lighted Saudi Arabia to...
an occupation. Yes.
Okay, so start us off there.
So Bahrain's revolution is really significant for a couple reasons. First, because it was actually the largest in terms of participation per capita, so per percentage of the population of any of the Arab Spring countries. So this was really a majority of the population, not just the youth, rising up and saying we want constitutional reforms. And that's the second part that's interesting. They weren't lobbying for a revolution. They just wanted reform. So this is like the most moderate, youth uprising that exists in the region. And we can't even back that.
What were the reforms they were asking for?
So right now it's a Sunni-controlled monarchy over a Shia majority. But it wasn't just the Shia who came out to protest. There were Sunni opposition as well, and they were just basically saying, like, they're actually lobbying for a constitutional monarchy, which isn't even a toppling of this regime. So they want to keep the monarchy, and the monarchy freaked out, basically for no reason. It would have just been reform.
And so what are some of the, like, PR strategies that the monarchy used to sort of preserve itself?
What was the freak out?
Yeah, right away they started arresting people. They killed a number of protesters right away, and that only, empowered the movement and, of course, galvanized families that could have been their kid. And not long after, the Saudi government, which is a very close, important ally of the United States, literally moved tanks onto the island. So this whole time the Sunni monarchy kept on saying, oh, this is Iranian meddling, and the opposition will always say, because the majority of the population is Shia and Iran Shia, the population will always say, in terms of foreign meddling, the only evidence we've seen of foreign meddling is the physical occupation of Saudi troops.
Yep. So Saudi Arabia, just to be clear, Saudi Arabia invaded Bahrain, much of whose police force is actually not Bahraini.
Mm-hmm.
Is another important factor is that they're so unpopular that they have to recruit foreign mercenaries to be cops there, which is crazy because you have people from Pakistan. They actually are trying to recruit some Syrians.
Mm-hmm.
Some Syrians and trying to pull them into the sectarian game. And, well, tell us about what's sad about the United States. I mean, because what I think is so interesting about this specific case is that we look down on, or a lot of people will look down on sort of the Arab world in general for being sectarian and for not being able to get over these petty disputes, but it's the oldest trick in the book for them to have said, oh, this is a sectarian game, it's Iran behind all the demonstrations, and we fell for it. I mean, we're a superpower, we're supposed to be a secular superpower, and we fell for that type of, like, simplistic sectarian garbage.
Definitely. So anyways. And there's, like, an inertia in Washington about security, and they're saying, you know, stability is the only way to ensure security. But the argument of the opposition is a minority controlling a majority is not sustainable. Mm-hmm. So if you want long-term sustainable relations with this region, support a reform movement that is by no means causing, you know, any problems, really. Like, I mean, this is not Syria we're talking about. This is not, you know, really a violent uprising. So this is a missed opportunity. And the United States has all the leverage in the world over this monarchy to just bring them to the table for a conversation and a process towards reform.
I think what's so interesting is that all of the it's like the way that the world is breaking down along authoritarian lines, it's almost as if people are just rejecting the future. Like, it's just so, it's so unthinkable to assume that, like, the king of Bahrain will live forever, or that Assad will live forever. You know, you like, people that argue for stability are going to have to explain to me why they think Syria would look the way it does now if Assad had been, like, eaten by wolves in 2011. You know, and if you really believe in the security over democracy argument, you'd have to assume that if a bolt of lightning struck him, then the entire country would be destroyed the way it is now. But that's just not the case. It's a process.
Well, it just seems interesting. Like, the trends that I see is that, you know, yeah, we're clinging to security. We're clinging to borders, not just in the Middle East, mm-hmm. but obviously we're putting up borders here in Europe, et cetera, while at the same time we have never had a more globalized world. And we are seeing borders disintegrate, not just in the Middle East, but beyond. So it's a, like, frantic clinging to an old order that actually didn't really work for the most of the world. But we haven't really imagined a constructive alternative yet.
It's like the system has never been so obviously a perversion of nature. You know, like, do you remember 20 years ago when every, like, weekly magazine cover was like, when will they discover a cure for AIDS? You know, this science fiction thing, one day we'll have a cure for AIDS. You know, oh my God, like, that would be incredible. There was a study released that basically people can have unprotected sex and live very long productive lives with retroviral repressive medication. You know, I don't understand anything about how it works, but apparently you can live like a normal person. So we have a cure for AIDS, basically. I mean, it doesn't eradicate the disease, but people, if medicated, a person can live with AIDS. They don't have to die from it at all. There's no reason.
It's good.
And we've become
so... But a lot
of
people don't get access to medication or find out too late, but yeah.
Exactly.
Dying from poverty, mm-hmm. not disease.
Yeah, and so we have this amazing technology, but now that we sort of can see this in the light of day, people are going to start demanding their rights. They're going to say that they're being fucked over. I mean, it's so obvious that people are being fucked over.
Definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, so on the theme of fucked over, tell us about how... Tell us about how this led to you making friends with...
Her story.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. How this led to you making friends with Bahraini activists, and tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, of course. So when we went to Bahrain the first time in 2011, it was shortly after the Saudis invaded Bahrain. And it was this great Arab Spring young journalist, social media story. We met these young people on Twitter who were like, we need this in American press. They were doing crazy things. They were, like, tweeting, like, hashtag Rihanna and Oprah. Really strategic moves to get their cause, like, in the mainstream media. It was hilarious. We were like, this is great. And they really set us up. We go to Bahrain undercover as reporters, but entered on tourist visas, as we did in the future when we were arrested. And we met with all sorts of incredible young activists. And that was, you know, immensely inspiring. Again, like, you know, I met a guy who was a banker, and he was a really pivotal, like, anti-torture activist. And, you know, you don't really think bankers are going to be involved in the revolution. He was saying, listen, like, this could be the Singapore of the Middle East. We just want everyone in our society to be able to fully participate in social life. So, again, not really radical, but that is when we met a really important colleague of ours, Nabil Rajab. He is a Bahraini human rights activist. He's actually an older guy. He is, and he was this incredible, like, social media guru. Out of his room, he was live streaming at the time. There was really shitty live stream apps at the time, and he was using them. And he was using them as a way during the curfews when everybody was trapped in their homes. He was broadcasting information about their loved ones. So everyone was getting picked up and kidnapped. Bodies were getting released, tortures. And he was the one who, as a human rights defender, really getting everybody the information about those who their loved ones who were lost or abducted, etc. So he was a very key activist, and we met with him just hours after the police stormed his home. His daughter was home from school. His chickens were dead because they had just come in and tear gassed his home. So we met him at a really dramatic moment back in 2011. But flash forward to our arrest this year, I'd been in touch with Nabil again about our reporting. But I also didn't want to, you know, incriminate ourselves when we entered the country because we assumed his communications were monitored, even though we were all doing all sorts of, like, encrypted communication. But so he didn't even know we were there that week until our sound guy was arrested before the rest of us were, and he was the first call I made as a friend, not just as a colleague, because I figured, A, he knows how to do this because he is, you know, caseworker for so many families of people who've been kidnapped by the regime. And then, B, he was a friend, a trusted source. And he really helped mobilize, find us a lawyer, support our families, and, you know, expedite our release. Today, he has been rearrested. This week, they just decided that they were going to postpone his court date for another month, which means he'll remain in solitary confinement for another month. Mm. His health has deteriorated. He was moved to a hospital for about 24 hours a couple weeks ago. And his wife and children are, you know, terrified, of course, and he's dealing with a government that provides no justice.
I think that there's a lesson there in the – not a lesson, but there's something to be learned there in the bureaucracy of evil, in a sense. You know, because we – tend to, you know, like Egypt has a court system, you know.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
That's ruled against El Sisi apparently once about that island deal with Saudi Arabia. But otherwise, you know, it can still be a tool of, like, naked repression.
Definitely.
And I think that we fail to grasp the mountain of bullshit that accompanies any acts of repression.
Of course. And one thing I would say in terms of another claim to fame that Bahrain has, I said it has one of the biggest Arab Spring movements of any of the Arab Spring countries, but also now it has one of the largest numbers of prisoners per capita in the world. So they're up there with North Korea. It's really remarkable.
Wow.
The scale of repression given the small size of the population.
And a tiny country.
Tiny island, yeah.
What's the perspective of the leaders? Have you had a chance to speak to any of the security people?
Yeah, so... they're using, you know, classic fear-mongering counterterrorism narrative, you know, fear-mongering about Iran. We do have a precedent in the United States. They halted arms sales to Bahrain after this violent crackdown in 2011. They resumed them primarily because Bahrain joined our counterterrorism efforts against ISIS. However, if we're going to talk about America's national security concern being ISIS and Bahrain being an ally, it's actually been the Bahraini police force who've had several members go join ISIS, while the opposition has no notable ties to Iran and just simply isn't part of this problem.
It's
mind blowing. Like,
it's so very
counterproductive.
It's so very interesting how much they resemble each other. These counter revolution strategies.
Yeah, you know, even here in the U.S.
And we look right now. Okay, I guess we can talk about Turkey. We look right now about.
Let's talk about Anna getting arrested.
Oh yeah, okay. But we'll get to that really quickly though. But it's interesting how so many of the strategies of the different regimes that claim to have, like, a sectarian interest against each other, they behave exactly the same way. You know, like, oh, all the Syrian revolutionaries are Saudi spies. All of the Bahraini revolutionaries are Iranian spies. Yada yada. Not terribly creative, really, in terms of the strategies.
Easy way to get someone killed in the Middle East. Call them a spy.
Yeah, easy way to get someone killed. Yeah, or just easy way to completely exterminate a country on top of it. Anyway, so yeah, you were speaking to human rights activists in Bahrain.
Yeah, so we were arrested. The rest of our team was arrested, and
this is for the anniversary.
Yeah. Came back this year to report on the anniversary, 5-year anniversary of the uprising, and we came in undercover. Bahrain is not issuing any kind of press credentials. There was a reporter there the previous week, and a number of reporters have gone in on tourist visas, and, you know, reported undercover, but only for a couple of days because it's a really small island. The police are going to find you. They're monitoring all the opposition. So anyone you want to meet with is monitored. And so these other reporters were just, like, arrested and then deported and fined. So we were prepared for that reality and anticipated it. So we were trying to do as much as we could before we got arrested. But when we were arrested, the charges heightened very quickly. And that was a result of first, you know, they were depriving us of a lawyer or our embassy, so we weren't really talking. But then they came in with a Huffington Post article that I wrote, like, with my picture on it.
The one that I read today?
Yeah.
Okay, I wonder if this had anything to do with her being arrested in this country.
Yeah, about, they're like, you're a journalist. And I'm like, we're not talking, blah, blah, blah. And, because we didn't want to really admit to a crime. We just figured they'd deport us, in a couple of hours. But the article was not just, you know, a reported piece about Bahrain. It was an opinion piece saying that they jailed their Gandhi, which was Nabil, who is in prison today. So not only did it incriminate us as a reporter, but it also incriminated us as being, you know, sympathetic to the opposition and close with Nabil, who, again, I would say he's probably the number one enemy of the state because he is so reasonable.
of course.
And that's why there are YouTube videos of you with your face saying bad.
Yes. Oh, and, okay. Good catch.
Yeah. Yes. And the police with good.
Yeah, and that's not going to resonate anywhere in the world right now.
Yeah. Honestly, Anna, it resonates with me very
hashtag
deeply.
Hashtag Kim Kardashian.
Yes. Oh, okay. God.
So you guys got released after about 24 hours?
Yeah, we released about 48 hours, yeah.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks, guys. No, really, it was definitely as a result of the press attention. Like, it blew up pretty quickly.
It was because of trolling, really.
There's a huge upselling of support for you. And there's a hashtag, Free Anna Day. Mm-hmm. And something about journalism, too.
Yeah.
There's another one, like, don't arrest journalists.
Journalism is not a crime.
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is, of course, it was immensely helpful. It's just reflecting on this today. I mean, this is some perspective of, like, the state of press freedom for Bahraini journalists who we met while we were there. And there's a woman who's my age who also cut her teeth reporting as a television reporter during the Arab Spring. She works for international media just like me, but she has a Bahraini passport. And when she was arrested, she was beaten with a hose pipe. She was punched, kicked, her head was put in a toilet, she was forced to drink urine. I mean, she was tortured. Mm. And today her torturers walk free. As of this last month, she was trying to leave the country and they put a travel ban on her. So it's like, of course, we were so grateful for the outpouring of support for our case and we needed it and it helped, but we have so much more power and we kind of need that outpouring of support for our Bahraini colleagues.
And there's a million cases like that.
Yeah,
I mean, for every Western journalist. And you know, like, I can easily blame the media for that, and I don't have any problem whatsoever, but you shouldn't blame the individual journalists, because everyone I know that's gotten released has advocated so strongly for their fixers, and I really can't think of any case where somebody hasn't. So I certainly wouldn't place the blame on the individual journalists, but it's absolutely crazy that the media treats an issue like this as if it's resolved when half of the crew is still imprisoned.
Yeah, well, we weren't working with them.
No, I don't mean specifically in your case, but I'm saying there's, like, Rasul, and there's, like, a million other...
Yeah, of course.
Cases like that all over
right now.
Yeah.
Journalism is not a crime.
Why do you think that...
Treated you like your time in jail was, like, not pretty either, right? I mean, how many days were you there and you didn't have water or...
Yeah, we didn't have, like, water, food. I mean, we were separated, so we all kind of had different experiences. Mine, I think, was a little bit different than my colleagues because I was the producer on the shoot, so I had the individual... contacts, and they wanted the names of the Bahrainis that we were with when we were arrested. And, I mean, that was really challenging because so many of these activists are underage, and Bahrain is very much known for jailing and torturing minors. So we were really, really worried when they started asking for our contacts. Of course, as journalists, we don't have to share our sources, but that's when our charges went from entering without a visa to participation in unlawful protest, rioting, terrorism, all these ridiculous charges that were not the original, you know, entry without a journalist visa.
Why do you think that journalists are pretty much like the most targeted profession and doctors?
Yeah, doctors, God, don't get me started. I mean, The doctor thing actually drives me crazy, obviously, because there's just such a need for life-saving talent in these places. Right. And, you know, you kill one, you're killing so many people. With journalists, I think Syria is the best example of what happens when you don't have journalists. We have more YouTube footage of that war than of any war in history. More YouTube hours.
It is the most
hours.
Recorded event in human history.
Yeah, more hours than there have been hours in the Syrian war. But because we can't verify it, and you heard Assad give a speech today where he says, like, well, you don't know, that's just on the internet. And that, like, casting of just a little bit of doubt makes it impossible for journalists to report it. And again, you have a torture of the likes of, you know, Hitler really operating without scrutiny and empowered by that privacy.
But I think the lesson that's so strange, because this is basically unknown to the general public, but there was sort of a coup in war reporting with the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
You know, because, and it's, I mean, it's the fault of the mainstream media because it's their own fucking fault for, you know, pulling out basically, like,
yeah, they definitely betrayed
cowering and leaving all the important stories. But it just got to a point where it's sort of like a catch-22, because you have to be fucking crazy to report that story. But you're the only person that's going to get reliable information by reporting, you know, from the front lines like you have. So it's a, I'm not calling you crazy, but it's a...
Well, I just think it was like massive cowardice, because we had, again, I go back to Syria on this, because other Arab Spring countries, like in Tahrir Square in Egypt, Al Jazeera kept that camera rolling, and that saved lives.
Yeah.
And when I entered Libya, there were murals of Al Jazeera reporters because they kept the camera rolling. Like, that really does matter, because lunatics act differently when the camera's on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we never had that in Syria. They killed several journalists right away. All the staffers got scared, pulled out. It became expensive but not impossible to cover Syria safely, and they cut corners with freelancers like us.
This is the... People always talk about trauma, and I have to say that I'm, like, an incredibly pampered person. Like, I don't deal with trauma or discomfort well, you know? So, and on top of it, I don't think that covering a war that I've had any, like, real trauma to myself, because I've never been injured, I've never had a relative raped, I've never, you know, lost a child. Like, all of the things that every single person that I know in that country has have never happened to me. So I don't have any real trauma. But something that I bring back from any time that I'm out there, it's been over a year, is just like this disgusting contempt for people that don't have sympathy. Because it's easy, like, if you don't see this like in the flesh, it's easy to buy that old line of, oh, well, you know, it's complicated. Like, yeah, it's true, it is complicated. The Middle East is very complicated. But even for the things that are not complicated, we fail miserably.
Yeah.
You know, like, sometimes they were to Bab Salama, they were bringing the wrong aid. Like, they didn't need more rice, but they needed fucking shoes that cover your whole feet. And you have people just dying from...
Yeah.
I think Bab Salama for me is really more traumatizing than Aleppo, actually.
Yeah, I can tell them about Bab Salama. Bab Salama is a internally displaced camp inside Syria that Pat and I reported in together. And it's a little border camp. It's not official refugee camp, so they're still inside Syria. Mm-hmm. But they're half a mile from Turkey, and they're on a little bit of a hill. So literally it's tens of thousands of people waiting to get into Turkey, which every refugee on earth has the right under international law to enter or to flee their country.
Yep.
So they're being denied their rights as civilians in war. They've been waiting there for 5 years now. And I met somebody, Pat and I were there one time, and, you know, we met people who had children who died of diarrhea, children who froze to death.
Yeah.
When they're in eyesight of...
A NATO country.
Of a country that has a hospital half a mile away.
So that really, like, that, like, plants a seed of hatred in my heart in a weird way, because, you know, the drone operator that
that's a betrayal,
Yeah, the drone operator that kills 50 civilians, I don't like it. You know what I mean? I think that that's very evil. But in a way, like, there's some logic that he's using to justify that, at least from his perspective, right? But when you go there, you say, wait. This person is actually dying from drowning in shit, which happened.
Yeah, literally drowning
like,
in
literally
shit.
Like, literally that happened to a child last winter in Bab al-Salam. Yeah. They drowned. They fell into, like, a little open pit of sewage, and they drowned. And that's ridiculous. That's shameful. I mean,
there are a lot of problems on Syria that are complicated. That's not one of them.
That's not complicated. There's nothing that's complicated about it. And just the level of cowardice is just... Sometimes I feel like I'm living in a dream, because when... Like, a nightmare, because... At the beginning, when you first started covering this, you know, it just seemed so atrocious, and it just seemed... We started talking about this weirdo group called ISIS, which Anna was one of the first American reporters to actually report on.
Thanks, Matt.
Nice. Yeah, all us Occupy Wall Street, you know, fucking wusses that have no interest whatsoever. And yeah, so when the GOP was crying and just sobbing and, you know, threatening to cut their penises off because of gay marriage, Anna was basically ringing alarm bells about this weirdo group that nobody took seriously called the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham. I've never heard of them. Have you?
Yeah. I mean, the horror that precipitated in this vacuum of support from the West, support from anybody, and then a horrible dictator was crazy, and that gave rise to ISIS. Mm. But when I started reporting, it was 2012. It was the fall. I was started reporting.
So we showed up around the same time.
Yeah.
Fuck.
But also, you know, that we showed up the same time as our colleague Austin Tice, who remains in captivity to this day.
Did you know him?
I don't know him personally very well, just from the internet. Austin Tice, Jim Foley was kidnapped a month later. So we were all freelancers filling the void of staffers, trying to cover this, working under the same conditions that led to our, you know, colleagues' captivity and then ultimately their execution.
Yeah.
But that period of just, you know, 6 months, I remember a veteran reporter that I was working with, he like let me and some activists like tag along to like get experience, and we were giving him information about the war and everything. And he was like, I'm going to leave. And we're like, you can't leave, because, I mean, it seems like your whole world, like no one should ever want to leave Syria, because it's just you're part of that crisis and you want to help and you feel guilty being away. And he goes, don't worry, I'll see you in the spring. And me and this activist just shrank, because neither of us could fathom that this could possibly be going on this spring.
Right.
And that would, we would have been talking about the spring of 2015, and we are in the fall of 2016.
What's terrified the shit out of me is that, because when again, like, we were sort of, like, there's sort of the Cassandra complex, because there were a lot of reporters who are mostly, I'm sorry, every reporter I know that, like, knew about ISIS and cared about ISIS is somebody that is deeply passionate about refugees. So that's, you cannot separate those two. Is, if you don't like refugees, you love ISIS, and you should join them. Fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, it's, it's not, you can't separate.
Just put hateful fascists all in one place and let them kill each other.
Well, that's what's quite interesting, is that this is why I love this election, actually, in a weird way, because it's like all the scum are kind of like floating to the same corner of the toilet.
Yeah,
in a strange way.
Trump to the Islamic State.
Right. It's like Putin, Trump, they love each other. Sheldon Anderson might bail out Trump. He's the AIPAC guy. You know, it's all these people that are supposed to hate each other. Iran basically wants Trump. Like, it's just a big fucking love fest for this guy. And I'm sure it's because they want us to be really strong and powerful, you know?
Oh.
Yeah. But it's very strange to see different strands of authoritarians buddy up to each other. You know, we're seeing Israel and Russia are cozying up like crazy. This is absolutely unprecedented. Weapons
Pat
sales.
Called that.
Sorry?
Pat called that. Everybody.
I called it.
What are you guys' predictions now?
We're all fucked.
Call it.
For what?
I don't know, the next year, since you guys are always right.
No, I've been wrong before. I've been wrong before.
I mean, I think it'll be interesting. It depends on the candidate. But, like, with Hillary, her strategy on Syria, it's never – I'm not saying, like, she was necessarily right, but it's always been logical. And Obama's always been late. So if you're going to choose a course of action, choose it and follow through.
Yeah.
And she actually has been consistent in making that choice and following up on it.
Shitty for Palestine, good for Syria. That's basically her.
So, no one's going to be good for Palestine. Losing
team. Well,
always.
I was pretty. Bernie has my heart, honestly. But
Bernie has everyone's heart.
Okay, so this is a very special recording, which, and I'm going to tell you, you're going to recognize it when I play it, but I'm going to tell you why it's special, and then we're going to get to Kristen reading social media. Okay, so this is actually a special recording of this song. Let me tell you why. All right. This is actually in Kamishlo. And these are all Kurds.
Amazing.
That are singing Ibrahim Kashush. And right now we see Kurdish and Arab opposition fighters fighting each other, and it's over nothing, and it's over bullshit in some cases. I mean, from the Kurdish perspective, they have a nation to defend, but there's... It's tragic.
It's a splintering of an opposition that wasn't splintered. Yeah.
Yeah. And of there's so many examples of people crossing that sectarian divide. I remember when the bombing of Russia so recently became... the bombing of Aleppo by Russia became so serious, and Saudi bombing was happening in Yemen at the same time, Aleppo City Civil Defense was tweeting in solidarity with the Shia who are being bombed in Yemen.
Amazing.
Yeah, so never...
Solidarity of survivors.
Of survivors. Anyway, social media.
I don't have anything from social media.
So is it going to be Wacky Adventures then?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Okay.
By Anonymous.
It's going to be Wacky Adventures.
Excited. Breezy morning?
Yeah, breezy morning is good. This one's a little...
No, that's not the one I wanted. Throwing piss.
Okay, throwing piss. This is a little story.
We're going to see St. Vincent at a bar in Bushwick with Dale. The venue is deep and dark, and Sasha is dressed like a metal baby, gray stockings up the leg, dark red lipstick, and a black t-shirt. I buy a drink and slip into the bathroom. I pull a baggie out from under the aspirin bottle I keep in the zipper of my Adidas jumper. I snort fierce and zipper my... I snort fierce and taste the mighty drip. When I come back, the bar is gold on dark like a Goya painting, and Sasha is fuming. She's just sitting with Dale, arms crossed in the dim booth across from the bar, clearly pouting. That guy grabbed my ass, she says, pointing at a fat, slovenly white guy at the bar. Seriously? I didn't realize how bad it would become, but I already knew she loved trying to get me to fight people. Don't worry, you don't need to fight him, she says, effectively calling me a pussy. I never said I would fight him. I pause for a moment, thinking of how to control this situation with my ego intact. I am hit with a sudden instinct to be sneaky. Actually, I have a plan. Wait here. Enjoy your drink. Dale seems mopey, and I insist he be ready for some fun. I take my shot and wander back into the bathroom with the empty glass. In the filthy stall, I take out another dope baggie, yak one half to the head, then the other. I realize I still have Coke, so I add in a key or two to make it a speedball. Sasha knows I have the Coke, and I don't have to hide it from her. All the better, I pull out my little fellow and squeeze out a few cubic centimeters of urine. I return to the booth with my new shot of whiskey.
Quote unquote.
Scare quotes. I put it on the table in front of Dale. Whatever you do, don't drink this, okay? Okay. I scope out the bar area and then the door, which is guarded by one fat bouncer who is sitting on his big ass with a little flashlight checking IDs. Out the door, there is a ramp and tangent leading down to street level. It should be pretty easy to slip out here real quick, I think to myself, as I head back to the booth and my people. I peek over and notice that the fat ass grabber has seated himself on a table with a slew of friends. Okay, Sasha, go with Dale and get the car. Turn around so it isn't against traffic. Sasha, you sit in the front with Dale and leave the back door right open. Okay.
Anna, you can relate to this.
I walk up to the table where the fat guy is sitting with a cluster of friends. I put down my shot of whiskey and grab the bar stool closest to me. As Fatty and his crew stare at me with befuddlement, I lay the bar stool across the floor in front of the table between me and the other douchebags. In one quick motion, I toss the piss right at his chest and head quickly but smoothly to the door. I duck down under a couple of hipster dipshits, slam through the door and over the railing to street level. Dale has moved the car per my instructions. I picture the idiots tumbling over the bar stool for a hot second while I make my escape. I jump into the open back door. I yell at Dale, "Drive, motherfucker!" Back at the door, my junkie piss sucks into fuckface's shirt. We drive away as I laugh hysterically. Yeah.
Wacky adventure.
Wacky adventures. Okay, Kristen.
It's a really interesting story.
You had some things planned for the show, and I've completely... neglected you as a friend and co-host.
No, Anna was great. Just keep going.
Just keep going? Okay, well, then you have to read another Wacky Adventure.
Yes,
we
please.
Still have time to kill. So read the other one in the email.
Let's read a few.
Story time. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one by Anonymous. I'm 7 years old.
Oh, no, 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 no. Not this one. No, that's not in the email. No way.
Okay.
Oh, actually, yeah, fuck it. I don't care. Does anybody object?
Anonymous.
This is the same author as Go Ask Alice.
Oh, okay. Does anybody object to this one? No?
Same anonymous.
Okay, go for it.
What? I don't know what I'm endorsing.
You're not endorsing anything. It's just vulgar. I mean, okay. Breezy Morning, you're not going to read that one?
It's so exciting.
Breezy, where is it?
It's the one I just sent you. It's the one I just sent you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got it.
All right. There you go, fine.
Here we go. Breezy Morning by Anonymous. I'm thinking, the sky must have been beautiful this morning on the stroll up Avenue A towards Stuytown. I walk briskly under new fallen shade. I take a last glimpse at the death rattle of the bright day, which had started in an earnest hour ago at 3 p.m. I could have been fooled into thinking it was summer when I woke up. Now chills creep in, affecting my blood. I run across 14th so I can catch the last swish of daylight. To my right, beyond the highway on-ramps and the river are Brooklyn, Long Island, and the Atlantic Ocean. 1,600 feet above them, the contrails are smoldering, harbingers full of nightfall. Soon they will turn purple. The contrails ignite, bleeding fire. I zip across the wide road to the bright sidewalk in front of Associated Supermarket. I feel warmth through the thin hoodie as shards of sunlight slither up my forehead, along my back, and down my legs.
I love you.
On the dark side of the planet, I pull my hands into a bundle of fabric and shivers. The first pangs of sickness make me sense gravity. I'm keenly aware of the way the sky looms menacingly in deep blue technicolor. Now I'm certain it's not summer. Beside me, the fortress city lurches and hums. Just past it, to my back on the river's edge, a triple-barreled shotgun vomits while puffed skyward. I scurry along the sidewalk, past Associated to the corner at 1st and 14th, where the East Village turns back into New York City and heroin becomes illegal. I think of the downtown girls who live in Stuytown under their green framed windows, skinny little things who slip into white panties and worn t-shirts before bed. Hot girls who snort coke and don't waste time on heroin. There are families and Korean and families and kids and all sorts of other people who live there too. A Korean girl I fuck sometimes also lives there, if I recall correctly. I don't dwell on them too long because of how ragged I suddenly feel. Hopefully I will be able to my ears in a warm... Hopefully I'll be up to my ears in a warm, fuzzy ocean of nostalgia and retarded beauty within 2 hours. I cross towards the subway at the foot of the Red Fortress City, off to Russell's place, Midtown East. Russell is no asshole. He's a sweetheart, but he lives at the top of a castle. The building has a gray atrium the way a hotel would. He is a hippie who got fucked up on coke and is now on the pot. A doorman in imperial garments beckons me into the elevator and up to the 20th floor. I walk along the hall and look down on the fountain at the bottom of the atrium as I think of what a fall to the bottom would feel like and if it would be worth it, and what the hell would be like afterwards. No need to kill myself today because I can afford 3 bundles. Russell's place reminds me of an Upper East Side intellectual's apartment, except for the frames leaning on the wall and the sculptures of Buddha. I thump and Russell greets me at the door. He is a husky guy with a broad smile, gentle blue eyes, and balding blonde hair. He leads me into his hippie room with a PS3 and big screen. On demand and in his own bathroom, his parents don't care about the weed and they aren't here. Not bad. Russell knew me before I injected heroin when I was snorting it. Normally we would chill and watch TV in his man cave, but we actually have to deal with this and anything can still go wrong. Soon we are heading back underground. We talk about bullshit on the road. In my head, I'm frantically praying that my cell phone doesn't run out of batteries.
Okay, the end. Yeah,
the end. Bye, Anonymous.
Okay.
Anonymous is amazing.
Yeah, it's the best. We have strange clips from history that are actually completely indecipherable to our audience because they're in French.
Play a song?
Oh, you have a song
do
to play.
Do it. No, you have to do it. Just type in Keith Martin, try and make sure.
Okay, cool. Kristen, talk amazing. About some bullshit until then.
I don't know.
Well, what's something that annoyed you this week?
That's so many things.
We'll start. Begin. We have a little bit of time. Let's talk about the election a little bit. What?
Why?
What is it? What's the search?
Keith Martin, try and make sure. The cool thing from the weed perspective about the election is that Democrat, like, even the, like, libertarians kind of seem to be winning, like, the popular narrative on, like, the internet and shit. The Democratic Party platform, like, endorsed marijuana policy reform and medical marijuana, and the Republicans rejected it. And
amazing.
If Trump, like, Trump could help turn the Senate blue, and then that would be good because we would get rid of all the chairmen who, like, are crazy Republicans who are against weed. And if they're, like, to actually have, like, weed policy reform, you need Democrats in control of Congress. But, like, these libertarian fuck faces won't acknowledge that, like, Grassley runs their shit. So, that's well, happening. So, so I'm always accused of being a shill by potheads.
On the Republican side, they've declared that pornography is a public health hazard.
Yeah.
Not much to say about that.
My
I do not agree. I do not agree.
My apartment is a hazard zone.
Oh, God. Okay, is it on Last FM? Is it on Last FM?
No, SoundCloud.
SoundCloud. Keith Martin, what is it?
Try and make sure with an N sign. Like.
Try and what?
Make sure.
Okay. Make sure SoundCloud. I apologize to our no listeners.
We can just do something else.
Keith Martin on SoundCloud.
Another thing that was interesting. About weed was a story about Humboldt County where, like, everyone sells pot. Like, it's just so common that all the kids at the school smell like it just because, like, their houses are full of it and they're always around it. And it's, like, a town that was already screwed over by, like, the logging industry and a bunch of people who didn't leave and didn't flee and, like, wanted to stay in, like, the awesome redwoods, stayed and just sold pot, and that's what everyone does. But now that it's legal, and already with medical marijuana, they're getting, like, pushed out of the industry because they're still not, like, rich enough to buy into it. And so it's going to be this, like, whole area that's going to lose, like, a totally recognized part of their economy. But no one is talking about it. But anyway, there's a football team. And that Sports Illustrated wrote a story about and how that was affecting the team. The coach was like, they'd always say they smell like weed. But I'd say it wasn't because they were smoking it. They're just like, everyone does it. And they're the one, some guy, I think it was a coach, was like, I used football to get me out of here. They're like, it's the one normal thing they can do.
I was on the football team, by the way.
It was sad.
Kristen, I'm having a really hard time finding it. Can you come over here and I'll tell a story about how I was on the football team?
Just forget it. Let's do something else.
Okay, I was on the football team for 20 minutes in high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was glorious.
And baseball with that shirt?
No, I was never in the baseball team. Well, yeah, I didn't. Grade school. But yeah, me and my friend were tall. We were tall. And we were taller than the other freshmen. So they were like, you guys want to play football? And we were like, fuck yeah, we want to play football. So we, so there was a...
I have good football stories, kind of.
So there was a meeting. And they had a conversation where they were like, well, you know, we're going to be working out. We're going to be playing about one game a week. I don't know how football works. So, but like, we're going to play one game a week or whatever. And, you know, it's physically straining, yada, yada. And we're like, okay, whatever. And then they're like, and, oh, yeah, it's going to be 2 hours of practice every day. And we're like, oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, we're not going to be doing that. So there was a long line, you know, to go to, like, wherever the fuck they went. I have no idea. And we kind of just looked at each other. We didn't say a word, and we just stepped off, you know. And we did not play football. But what's cool is I accidentally got credit for it one semester because I'd signed something at some point. So at some point,
terrific.
They registered in their log that I was a football player. So that's my glorious football career.
On your college apps.
Yeah, and I like to talk about it. Do we want to talk about A Strange Night in Achilles or no?
I sent you no? music.
Sure, yeah. Okay, all right. Well, this is actually a great story that I'm so glad that we can tell. Anna, can you
We've been waiting years to tell
we actually have been. We have been waiting years to tell this story.
About the smuggler?
About the smuggler.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well...
Went to the wrong city.
Well, no, we're
this is another alive. Time when you guys were told the future.
Yes, we this is actually...
This is true.
Is this when you, like, first got your powers?
I guess
Maybe.
So. I mean, but our power, skepticism is also power, and it kind of like fucked us in that situation, which is really interesting. So should I just set the scene?
Yeah.
Okay. So we were in Achilles after like a very, very strange commute, which is how I describe it.
Pat videoed every step of it.
It's good. It's garbage in the
Anna,
time being,
look
but
dramatically out the window.
For the time being,
Anna,
it's garbage,
hold
but in the
your
future.
Suitcase and look around.
But in the future, that's going to be like Oscar
gold.
Worth,
I'm telling you.
Gold. Gold. Yeah, so we'd been literally commuting to Syria.
Because we were that broke.
Yeah.
And like we took public transportation.
Yeah. Yeah, we were taking Turkish public transportation to Syria. That's right. We were back and forth. And we had borrowed one flak jacket.
Yeah, from Emma Beals, God bless her.
Yeah, that was, but, I mean, it wasn't the right place for it, but whatever. So anyways.
Between the two of us.
Yeah, it's fine. So we were going back and forth, very strange commute, worst hotel in the world, legendary, absolutely legendary. The smell is also legendary. And so we'd been commuting back and forth into Syria. We actually got a bunch of really good material, shockingly, mm-hmm. for not having any plan whatsoever. And finally, it was kind of like one night, and we'd wanted to sort of cover smugglers. And a translator that we were in touch with, who shall remain nameless, was able to put us in touch with a smuggler.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, so we meet him at a cafe.
Okay, but the crazy thing is, Pat, I met
him. I remember,
previously.
Yeah. Oh, no, I remember it clearly because
so
it terrified
up,
the bejesus
like,
out of me.
This guy, because I met him like a year earlier and he was making fake passports. Like he was hustling refugees.
He was smuggling for different people, though.
Yeah. So he was like ripping off refugees and part of like the war industry on the border. And then this time he was, he had made passports for some incredibly high level designated terrorists.
Yeah.
Organizations, and he kind of wanted us to like hook him up with the CIA so he could get protection,
so he could escape and not do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And we were like, they'll kill you,
and we're like, you've screwed over way too many people, and you're definitely in the black market. Like, they're not gonna help you, you know.
Yeah, it's weird because he's an evil guy, but he just seemed like nice at the time. But whatever. So he starts ranting, and it literally looked like the Syrian cast of The Sopranos. It was fucking nuts. Like, they're literally wearing black Adidas jumpsuits, except for the guy had like terrified eyes, and like it sounded like so much bullshit. But anyway, so he starts like just rambling about how he's saying, I'm telling you, like ISIS is gonna. I forget the exact timeline, but he was saying ISIS is gonna take the dam in Mosul. Was that before or after?
No, he just goes on and on about Mosul, and we're like, we can't hear it. We're trying to go to Aleppo.
Yeah, and like, we're like...
That's hard enough.
And he started talking, and he said there's a shrine in Turkey. He said there's a shrine in...
Tabik.
There's a shrine in Tabik. And, like, unofficially, the Turks are allowed to occupy it, and...
Oh.
Yeah.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah. And it's because it was Atatürk's grandfather that's buried there, and there's a little garrison of Turkish soldiers, right? And we're literally looking at each other, and we're like, I'm so fucking pissed that, like, we spent money on a translator today because this is such fucking bullshit. Like,
and this guy again, this is the badass smuggler you took us to?
And he's showing us pictures of, like, terrorists on his iPhone.
Yeah, but they were actually legit. But it was like, we already knew you, so...
But then he says something that's fucking crazy, which is he says they want to erase the border between Iraq and Syria, right?
And they're doing it with Mosul next week.
And we're like, fuck you,
we're
bullshit.
Like, fuck you, we gotta focus on Aleppo. It's scary enough.
And then we eat dinner afterwards at a terrifying Turkish version of McDonald's, which was, remember I was talking about? Upstairs, red, everything just very little and very sinister. We have 30 seconds left, just so that everybody knows. But yeah, so, and then a couple days later, we're in the hotel. I was eating cheese. I remember that. And then we look on the television and we're like, what the motherfuck? Like, half of the shit that he said just came true.
True.
So the point is, pay attention, motherfuckers, because shit's
always
happening.
Always trust a smuggler.
The shrine is real.
Don't trust but verify, in the words of our greatest president, Ronald Reagan, who was not our greatest president. My guest, Anna Therese Day.
Thanks,
my co-host, Kristen Gwynn. I love you all. Good night. And never open a hell mouth.